So good afternoon, everybody. How was your lunch? Are you feeling well fed? Quite a contrast, I guess, to some of the discussion we've had this morning. So my name is John Kennelly, and it's my pleasure to chair this session with V.J. Raghavan, who is sitting out here. So we will follow the same format as the previous sessions, where we will ask speakers to confine themselves to 15 minutes, and we will keep the questions to the end. So before I begin, I would like to congratulate Chandra and his team for putting on this conference. You can accept a bow there, Chandra, not just for the conference, but for your new institute. I mean, the leadership you're showing is very commendable, so congratulations. So ladies and gentlemen, this session is about water. And I guess I don't need to tell you that this substance is essential for life. We obviously know it's essential for our life, but it's also essential for all other life on Earth. And so obviously the way that water is used and the amount that's available is a critical factor in terms of the food that we produce on this planet. And so this afternoon, we're going to be addressing that topic and addressing it in the context that we know that already, even before we reach a population of $9 billion, that water availability is a challenge. And we have the contrast sometimes, even in Western Canada, where we may have a province like Manitoba, for example, that has got too much water at the same time as and not too far away in Alberta, we are suffering from drought. So it's not always just the amount of water that's available that's critical, it's also obviously the distribution of that water and the distribution of that water at a time when it's necessary for crop growth. The other factor, of course, that's coming into play is that with industrial development, the demands on that water supply continue to increase. Agriculture traditionally has used about 70% of the water. But as industrial expansion occurs and those industries have a greater need for water, then you have competition for those water resources. And on top of that, as climate changes, you are going to get changes in the patterns of water, and in different areas of the world, you're going to have perhaps more water than is required, and in other places, major problems in terms of water shortage. So clearly this afternoon's session is a very critical one within the overall context of global food security. Our first speaker this afternoon is Bart Schultz, and he's a professor of land and water development at UNESCO IHE. His career includes more than 35 years of research, advising and project implementation in the field of land and water development, drainage, irrigation, flood management, and environmental engineering. Please welcome Bart to the podium. Special welcome song.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues. I have been asked to say a few words in these 15 minutes on the role of the humid tropics in food production. I'd like to give a brief introduction. And especially I like to pay attention to population growth and urbanization, and from that on the opportunities of lowlands in the humid tropics for food production, some future outlook and some final remarks. Lowlands, flood-prone areas are all over the world, along the coasts, in river floodplains and as inland depressions. Basically, it are sensitive areas with a high ecological value. And so they are unsuitable for development. But due to the strategic location of these areas, there is a tremendous pressure to develop them for various type of land use. I heard this morning many times the word climate change. We are all concerned about climate change, but about 90% of our houses are built in flood-prone areas. So if we really take climate change seriously, we should not build any houses there anymore. But that is not what we do. And that is because of the strategic location. I show you the bars, and I do a little different since many years than many of the developing organizations. I split the world in three groups and not in two, developing, because for water management and food production, I feel, and with me many others in the International Commission on Irrigation and Drainage, that there is quite a distinction between the emerging countries and the least developed countries. So what you see in these bars is the distinction in three groups: the developed countries, emerging countries, and the least developed countries, and then the figures for 2005, 2025, and 2050. And what you see is that the developed countries are well off because their population is not growing anymore. We have a stable population. The emerging countries, the large parts of the bar, they house 74% of the world's population. And they are still growing. And you have to think of India, of China, most of Latin America, Indonesia, Pakistan, those countries, 74% of the world population. These people are food self-sufficient. That may be surprising for us, but you don't see that when you don't make the distinction in least developed and emerging countries. But overall, there is a small deficit in the emerging countries, but they are food self-sufficient. That does not mean that everybody within those countries have food, but on a country basis, they are self-sufficient. And then you have the least developed countries, about 800 million people at the moment, about 50 countries, and they have the most rapid population growth. The other striking figure is that they have to import about 30% of their food, be it either by import or by food aid. And that is quite strange because it are all agriculture-based economies. I give you one table only with a little large number of figures in it. But I like to show that I took four humid tropical countries, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand and Vietnam, and I compared them with Asia and the figures for the whole world. And I like to ask your special attention for the right four columns, that is population density in persons per square kilometer based on the geographic area as well as on the arable land. And then the figures for 2010 and 2050. And what you then generally see, that these humid tropical countries have a population density around the average of the world, Indonesia higher and close to the Asia average, and Vietnam extremely high. 1,230 people expected in 2050 per square kilometer, about two times as much as the global density. So the growth in these countries that I showed you in the previous bars is mainly concentrated in the urban areas. And the expectation is that in 50 years, 80% of the world population lives in the lowland flood-prone areas, and most of them on the cities. As an illustration of that, I inserted the map of Jakarta, and red is urban and green is rural, the map of 1972 and the map of 2005, and you see that the city of Jakarta is about 7-8 times as large as it was, say, 30 years ago. And that is valid for quite a lot of cities in the Asian continent. For the farming, this has very significant implementation because smallholder farmers, and we have discussed them quite a lot this morning, they eat most of their harvest. And what you need in these countries is a very significant change from smallholder farming to more large-scale farming production for the cities. It is not that I like that, but I observe those tendencies. What you get in these countries is increase in farm size and in higher value crops like vegetables and fruits to be able to produce for the urban areas and to be able to remain competitive with the salaries in the industry and the service sector. I show you, following the example of Jakarta, what I have done in this graph is to show you the percentage of urban population from 1950 to 2050 in steps of 20 years for those four countries as well as for Asia and the world. And what you see is that in the four countries in 1950, about 15 to 20% of the country was urban population, and in 2050 it is expected to be about 60% or even higher. So that is three times as much, and that is a very significant increase of the urban population. I have separated the graphs in the population growth in the rural area and in the urban area. And I only did that for the four countries. I can also show it to you for the whole world, but that is not so important related to my talk. And what you see is that in 100 years, the urban population, I take the biggest bars, the red ones, Indonesia, it will go from less than 10% urban population, less than 10 million urban people, it will go to almost 200 million people. And all these people like to eat. And so there is a lot of food production required. The also striking figure in these graphs is that the rural population in these four countries, and that is more or less a general figure for the emerging countries, is more or less at its peak. So you see in 2010, the red bar of 2010 is the highest, and the rural population is going down in these countries. That is not so much surprising. In Europe, about 2 to 3% of our people is still farming, and the other 98% are doing different things. And the same, I understand, you have in North America. So these countries just follow the normal sequence that we have had more or less in the past century, and I think in our forecast we have to carefully follow those developments in order to make the right judgment and the right approaches. So what are the challenges? To feed the growing world's population at affordable prices, especially the last one is also interesting. Improve the standard of living and environmental conditions in the rural area, and to develop land, to develop and manage land and water resources in a sustainable way during the coming decades, especially in the emerging and the least developed countries. Tidal lowlands, and lowlands in general, but tidal take a little special position, especially in the humid tropics, may significantly contribute to cope with these challenges. Why are they so significant? When the farmers are doing well and can make proper use of irrigation and drainage systems, then they can reach 3 harvests per year. And each harvest can be about 8 tons, so it is very significant production potential. In the lowlands, you have a regional layout. We go as a tourist to Indonesia or the Philippines to see all these nice sawas in the mountains, but they have no infrastructure. So they are in fact not very suitable for mechanization. While the lowlands are just flat, and you can make a very regional layout of the fields, you can introduce more than mechanization, and you can increase farm sizes easily. Importance of the water management infrastructure for these three crops is very important. Good operation and maintenance, and most of the schemes in these countries were originally government schemes, but governments cannot afford to continue with operation and maintenance. So there is an increased participation of the users, the stakeholders. There may be medium to long-term problems, and it's interesting, we all speak of sea level rise, but the worst in these areas is land subsidence. It is going in quite some of these areas much faster than the sea level rise. I showed you the figure of Jakarta, which is not rural, of course, but the city is going down with 5 to 10 centimeters per year. Impact of sea level rise at maximum is 60 centimeters per century. Jakarta is doing that in 6 to 12 years. And then the government is saying we have a problem with climate change. I show you the example of Indonesia. While in Indonesia the changes are going so rapid. In Vietnam it is longer, in Thailand it is also longer. But Indonesia has had a big program to settle people in the tidal lowlands. And this is a picture taken around the beginning of the 80s, the 1980s. They were settled between the 1970s and the 1980s. And this is the way that they started. They got 2 hectares from the government, 1/4 hectare for the home yard, as they call it, where they can grow vegetables and fruits, and they have a house like this. That is how they arrived in these areas. Now, the yield by that time was about 0.5 to 1 ton per hectare. Now the best farmers, they don't have 2 hectares anymore. The best ones have 20 hectares. So a lot of their neighbors have already gone to the urban areas back again, and the others have taken over. And if you go now around in those areas, you see a lot of building activities to build houses like this. So it is quite changed, but it took 25 to 30 years. And here is an example of a field with 8 ton per hectare. How can they do that in the tidal lowlands? I show you a typical example of a flapgate. The tidal lowlands have the advantage of tidal fluctuation. So with high tide, you can supply water to the tertiary canals. And at low tide, you can discharge the water from the tertiary canals. This is what we call a movable flapgate. So they can put it in the dry period in the supply position, and in the wet period they can put it on the discharge position. And when the farmers understand how to do this, and that took of course with the first one quite some time to explain it, then they are very well off and their harvest is rapidly increasing. Another feature, this is a structure in a secondary canal. There are about 125 farmers served by such structures. And these 125 farmers are unable to reach agreement how to use the structure in the secondary canal. It is too much for them. So why build it when you cannot operate it? And that is a big problem in a lot of these systems. Actors in agricultural water management. The first time I made this figure, I thought it was not really required to make it. But I hear very often at many places, water management is everybody's business, which is of course a good slogan, but it is not everybody's business. There are three responsible, and that is government, the irrigation or drainage agencies, and it are the farmers. These three are really responsible to manage the business. And what you see in many countries, if they reach agreement, then it works, and you don't have to be concerned about feasibility. When these three parties cannot reach agreement, it will generally be a mess. And whatever you do, it will not be solved. So be aware of these very important aspects of agricultural water management. Of course, there are many others involved to make projects a success or to make the operation of a scheme a success, like the consultants and the contractors. But when consultants don't get a contract from an irrigation or drainage agency or from a government, they don't have a job. So they are contributed, as I called it here. So what will be the future outlook? Global food production has to be doubled more or less in 25 to 30 years. 80 to 90% from that increase in food production has to come from existing cultivated land, and to a large extent by better water management through irrigation and drainage. On the other hand, we see that a lot of agricultural areas are taken out of production. So we really have a problem. In the Isle of Java in Indonesia, annually, 40,000 hectares is transferred from agricultural area to urban area. So we may expect a large-scale modernization of irrigation and drainage systems and increasingly flood protection, because if the value of the crop increases, farmers don't like to have their land flooded anymore. So therefore, for countries, it will be very important to have a development and management strategy on maintaining food security, taking into account the short, the medium, and the long-term perspectives, especially with respect to the lowlands. I'd like to conclude my presentation, Mr. Chairman. I think I am even within the time because I did not see any shield. Tidal lowlands in the humid tropics have a tremendous potential for food production. However, existing cultivated tidal lowlands may have to be improved. For new reclamations, careful selection of areas, as well as of the development approach, will be of major importance for success. In such approaches, the specific physical conditions have to play an important role in order to prevent reduced benefits from general considerable investments. Thank you very much for your attention.